Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning and Happy New Year, everybody. It's 1 minute before 10 o'clock. Do you know where your sober brain is? And it's not just New Year's Day. It's Inauguration Day. For the first time since January 1st, 2002, New York City will be swearing in a new mayor today. And we will bring you live coverage of the inaugural ceremonies, highlighted by Mayor Bill de Blasio's inaugural address. Our coverage begins in about an hour. And fittingly, I hope, for this hour, we will bid farewell to Mayor Michael Bloomberg by re-airing a special we did a few weeks ago called Three Questions About the Bloomberg Years. Did Mayor Bloomberg make you healthier? Did Mayor Bloomberg make us less equal? And did Mayor Bloomberg secure the city's future? We'll tackle these questions over the next hour or so and build our conversations around a farewell address that the mayor gave to the Association for a Better New York. And let's begin by listening to part of that speech. People often say that Bill de Blasio was elected because of his values, while Bloomberg was a technocrat. But Mayor Mike framed this farewell speech around a list of values, specifically seven of them.
Now, the values I've mentioned this morning are, I believe, values that run deep in our DNA as New Yorkers. At our best, we are a city that is defined by freedom, diversity, and equality. We are a city that ensures opportunity for all. We are a city that champions economic innovation and artistic expression. We are a city that invests in the future, that adopts compassionate and effective social policies, and that protects the health and safety of all New Yorkers in all communities. That is the New York that I know and love. That is the New York you know and love. And it's the New York we have worked together to build for the past 12 years.
New York City values, according to Michael Bloomberg. We know that public health has been one of Mayor Bloomberg's passions, critics say a nanny state obsession. So let's look at the results to begin the program. Did Mayor Bloomberg make us healthier? Here's another minute from his farewell address devoted to the topic.
New York City is at its best when its values and has the courage to defend them, and that is public health and safety. In the 19th century, New York was the first major city to create a Board of Health to battle disease. And in the earliest 20th century, we became the first major city to create a public health laboratory. Our administration has upheld that tradition and extended it into the 21st century. From banning smoking and trans fats to adopting calorie counts and battling obesity, no city in the world has done more to improve public health than we have. And the proof is in the fact that today, New Yorkers are living longer and healthier lives. In fact, since 2001, life expectancy in our city has increased by nearly 3 years, far outpacing the national average. Now, one reason for those gains has been our commitment to reducing violent crime and fighting illegal guns. No city in the country has done more to crack down on illegal guns than we have. And one result is that murder has declined much more steeply than anywhere else in the country. In the country as a whole, murder declined by 15% from 2001 to 2012. In New York City, it declined by 38%. And this year, we're on pace to shatter the record for the fewest number of murders in the city's modern history.
Again, Mayor Michael Bloomberg from his farewell address last week to the Association for a Better New York, and his focus on smoking, trans fats, and giant sodas, his campaign for stronger gun laws to keep guns from coming into New York, and the stop and frisk program to find them here, controversial though many of these things were all of a piece, his goal to increase public health and safety. So let's talk about that part of the Bloomberg legacy first, with Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition and public health at NYU, author of books including Eat, Drink, Vote, and An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, and Richard Aborn, president of the Citizens Crime Commission of New York City, a crime and safety think tank and advocacy group. Marion, Richard, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Glad to be here.
By the way, Marion Nessel, do I understand correctly that we have reached you today at the White House?
You do.
Doing something with the First Lady on the Let's Move Fight Obesity campaign?
Well, there's a policy briefing this morning that I'm going to.
All right. Well, you heard some of the mayor's stats from that speech, and I'll add a few. From 2006 to 2010, life expectancy rose in the city by 3 years, outpacing the national average of 1.7 years. From 2002 to 2009, adult smoking decreased by 27% in the city. One study from the American Journal of Public Health found that the New York State workplace ban on smoking likely prevented 3,800 yearly hospitalizations for heart attacks related to secondhand smoke. And also the rate of obesity in New York City children decreased by 5.5% from 2006 to 2011. So is the mayor on solid ground with his speech? Did he make us healthier?
Well, I think he certainly pushed it in the right direction. And what he did that was really remarkable was to appoint two consecutive public health directors, Tom Frieden and Tom Farley, who were really serious about public health and met with their staffs to try to figure out what they could do within their legal mandates to try to create an environment that would promote health. And they were very successful in thinking about lots of ways of doing that. Some of them have gone national, like menu labeling, which is now national law, although the regulations haven't gone into effect yet, and some of which are really leading-edge kinds of approaches, like the soda cap. Controversial though it may be, it was a really interesting idea and an experiment well worth trying.
How about the increase in life expectancy? Can you tease those stats out? Who is living longer, and what aren't they dying of as early?
Well, this is a secular trend, and it's happening across our society in general, where relatively wealthy, educated people are living longer, and poor people who are not. And it's part of the whole trend in rising inequality between the rich and poor in the United States. One of the ways you see that is in discrepancy in life expectancy.
Eric in Fort Greene, did Mayor Bloomberg make you healthier?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a musician. I've been a musician in the city for about 15 years. And, you know, when I play shows that have several sets, you know, the first thing you do when you get off stage is you light a cigarette. And the smoking ban in bars prevented me from wanting to do that. So I actually quit smoking because I couldn't smoke after set.
All right. Good one. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Carly in Harlem. Did Mayor Bloomberg make you healthier?
Yeah, I think so. I am asthmatic, and I moved here 6 years ago, and I have to say that if he hadn't banned smoking indoors, I probably wouldn't have moved to New York City because I would just be having asthma attacks all the time. So I'll give him credit for that.
Carly, thank you very much. Anyone else? Did Mayor Bloomberg make you healthier? Do you think his policies have contributed to behavior change on your part, or less environmental risk to your health, as we just heard from our first two callers, or not? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, specifically on the calorie counts, posting those on menus in chain restaurants, according to Scientific American, most studies show the calorie count has had little effect on public consumption. So, as a nutrition and public health professor, Marion, do you think there's good evidence that it doesn't actually matter? You walk into McDonald's or Subway or pick your place and you see one thing that you might order has 1,500 calories and another thing has 500 calories. Doesn't affect people's behavior, or do you think it does?
Well, it certainly affects my behavior without question. The studies don't tend to differentiate between people who look at the calorie counts and people who don't. The studies that do make that differentiation tend to show that people who look at the calorie counts change their behavior as a result of it. And it certainly changes mine. There's no question about that.
And listeners, let's add to this question as we bring in Richard Ayborn. Has Mayor Bloomberg made you safer? We know crime is down in the city. We know there are some very dangerous neighborhoods still in the city. But have you experienced more safety, a feeling of more safety or an actuality of more safety in New York City in the last 12 years, if you've been here for most of that time. 212-433-WNYC. And Richard Aborn, Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission. The drop in crime is dramatic, and it's real, right? It's not a statistical fluke.
It is very real. I think it's more than dramatic. I think it's almost breathtaking. Ray Kelly and Mayor Bloomberg have achieved drops in crime that, frankly, none of us thought were possible at this point. I mean, just to give you a snapshot, in the 1990s itself, we had over 2,000 murders in that year. Last year, we had just a few murders over 400, and this year, we're looking at a murder rate below 400. It'll be somewhere in the mid-threes. That is just a remarkable decline in the murder rate, and we see that trend in almost every single category of crime. To be sure, there are some neighborhoods where we still have a lot of work to do, but even in the more dangerous neighborhoods, crime has come down dramatically. So I think the NYPD, Commissioner Kelly, and Mayor Bloomberg get significant credit for this.
One thing about murders, though, these declines in the murder rates year by year are incredible. They usually involve people who know each other and are committed for personal reasons or gang-related reasons or things like that. The street crime most people have to fear, I think it's accurate to say, is muggings. So how'd we do in that department in the last 12 years?
Very absolutely down as well. The only place where the what we call non-acquaintance crimes, where people don't know each other, a random crime, has started to go up is in the area of the theft of smart devices. Thieves are stealing cell phones that are smart devices for a variety of reasons. It is a growing issue, and it's one that I know the NYPD is going to try and get its hand around. We also see some growth in youth violence, both in gangs and what we call crews. We see kids being more aggressive with each other. We have always had a problem with guns in this city. We continue to have a problem with guns in this city, and they are grabbing guns, and they're engaging in shootings. But I have to say, even the number of shooting incidents and the number of shooting victims, in other words, people were shot but did not die, is also down dramatically over the last 12-year period. So, again, virtually in every single category of crime, we are making enormous strides. There is one caveat here, though, which is everybody's been aware of this sort of knockout punch phenomenon that took place in the last month or so. I think one of the reasons that has received so much attention is because of its random nature. We've become used to being very, very safe, and we're kind of shocked when there's a random crime now. That's both good news and bad news. The good news is we have become so safe, but we do have to maintain our sense of street savvy. Nobody's immune from crime out there.
And I feel like the debate over stop and frisk has taken all the air out of the room when talking about how crime has gone down this much. What would you say are the other main reasons, whether we give any attribution to stop and frisk or not? Other police practices or non-police factors, the end of the crack epidemic, which is old news by now, lower birth rates, whatever?
You have asked the quintessential, most difficult question. I think there are some emerging answers to it. I think 90% of the credit goes to the NYPD. They have adopted some very sophisticated tactics which are having a direct impact on crime. They have a very strong patrol strategy, but they're also using very advanced technological tools, basically analytic tools, to understand in a very nuanced way who's committing crimes, where those crimes are being committed, and the circumstances under which those crimes are being committed. And they're beginning to intervene before they occur. For instance, they're reaching out to would-be gang members in an effort to try and steer those kids away from gangs. They are knocking on the doors of domestic violence abusers and saying, we're here, just want to let you know we're watching. If you need anything, let us know. It's a way of sending a message that the cops are watching. These are innovative techniques that the department is using, and it's having a huge impact. They have also targeted gang activity, which was driving some of the murders, and we're seeing huge benefits from that as well. I think another big factor is New York, and this is not terribly well known, New York enjoys an incredibly vigorous and effective criminal justice system that surrounds the policing department, both on the prosecutorial side and all the groups that work on preventing crime. We've been very successful in driving down the recidivism rate, so people aren't going to prison, coming out, and committing new crimes at the same rate. We're doing a lot of very targeted work with kids who are beginning to show signs that they may become offenders, and we're beginning to steer them off the track. And then we're doing a lot of work around truancy now. Truancy, there's a direct link between truancy and youthful offending, and people are zeroing in on that as well. So you see the concept of crime fighting really expanding out. At the core, for sure, is the police department, but they're the hub. There are these other attributes going on in New York now, which have a very, very positive benefit. And if I just may note one other thing, I think, Brian, it's very interesting that you chose to combine an expert on public health and someone on crime, because there's even a direct correlation between some public health practices and crime fighting. If you think about epidemiology, it looks to reduce harm, usually accidental harm or harm caused by disease. Mm-hmm. But you can apply a lot of those same principles to intentional violence, and there's some very interesting research, still nascent, but some very interesting research coming out on correlations between inadequate diet, inadequate nutrition, and aggression, particularly around prison populations. So there's some interesting blending going on between the public health community and the crime-fighting community.
So Marion Essel is our public health guest. Do you want to weigh in on that?
I think it's very clear that healthier people are less likely to be violent. If you're healthy and you're educated and you have enough money to survive in society, there's no reason for you to be, you know, unless you have some mental illness or something like that. So all of these things operate together, and you want to see societies that create environments that promote public health always. And Bloomberg has done that.
Before we get to the de Blasio inauguration and the de Blasio years, we're asking three questions about the Bloomberg years this morning. Did Mayor Bloomberg make you safer and healthier? Did Mayor Bloomberg leave you behind? We'll get to that next. And did he secure our city's future? So on making you healthier and safer, Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I was going to say, I used to feel very safe in New York City streets, and I credit Bloomberg to that, Mayor Bloomberg. But, however, recently there's been a rash of knockout crimes, and I think it's directly correlated to the pushback in Stop and Frisk and other policies, whether it's due to lawsuits or the de Blasio victory or what have you, that Stop and Frisk has slowed down, thereby allowing people to be, you know, sort of, you know, they're less scared to what have you to do what they want to do, and the streets are currently less safe.
Alan, thank you. Although Richard Ayborn, I think we see, even in this year where there's something like an 80% reduction in stops and frisks compared to a year and 2 years ago, there's a similar drop in the murder rate, for example.
Well, that's right, and with deep respect to your caller, I understand the concern, and we should talk about that concern, but the data doesn't support it. The data shows pretty clearly that Commissioner Kelly began to turn down, if you will, the numbers of stops and frisks going on about 4 months ago, and it has dropped, I mean, way, way, way down. And interestingly, we're seeing the crime rate not only continue to go down, but the slide begin to accelerate. So we don't see a correlation between the decline in the number of stops and a rise in crime. It's actually the inverse that's happening. But sure. What I think your caller is referring to is the fear of crime. The fight against crime operates on two levels. One, the fight against direct crime, actual crime. But we also have to fight the perception of crime and make sure that we're very open and transparent with the public. The reason that your caller is feeling that, I believe, goes back to what I said earlier, which is these knockout punches have a random nature to them. They have a random feel to it. And back in the 90s, we were all worried about being mugged. That fear has disappeared. So the minute you get a little uptick in some of these random events, you get a disproportionate climb in the fear of crime. So we need to keep our hands on that. But there's no correlation that anyone sees between the decline in stops and these sorts of events.
Janet in Manhattan, did Bloomberg make you safer? Did he make you healthier?
Good morning. Certainly healthier in that secondhand smoke, although I had quit smoking sometime years earlier. I certainly appreciate not having to breathe in second smoke. But more importantly, the calorie count really had an impact on what and where I eat. Shortly after the law was enacted, I went into a Popeye's chicken restaurant, as I had always done, and I looked up at the menu on the board, and I saw some strange numbers after my usual order, and I finally figured out it was the calorie count, and I was truly shocked at how much calories my normal order was. I turned around, walked out, and never walked back in. And since that time, and when I do eat in public restaurants, I always do look for the calorie count.
Popeye's loss is Janet's gain. Thank you. Robin in Greenwich Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I want you to know that I hold Mayor Bloomberg personally responsible for the closing of St. Vincent's Hospital that saved my life when I had meningitis 12 years ago. People are actually dying because he didn't give a fraction of his millions to keep that hospital open. And we have no hospital in an 80-block radius. He doesn't like health care. He doesn't like teachers. I'm a teacher, and all the testing and his attitude towards against teachers' unions affects me as well. Why do people forget that he stopped recycling for the first 2 years of his mayorship? The stuff about smoking, California is way ahead of us there. A lot of places have stopped smoking. Actually, New York is behind the West Coast in caring for health. So I hold Bloomberg responsible for all these things. He's against health care and teachers. How can you say he's helped anybody in the city?
Robin, thank you. I don't think you could say he's against health care, but Marion Nestle specifically on the issue of St. Vincent's, which did happen on his watch. Can you measure a public health effect from the closing of that hospital?
I'm sure that you can, although I don't know how to do that. I think it was a great, great loss to the neighborhood. So I think when we're going to assess Bloomberg's overall performance, there are going to be things that he did that were terrific and things that he did that were much less terrific. And the historians will be working on it for years. I'm going to have to go to my meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So if I can sign off now. Thanks very much for having me on.
And we thank Marion Nestle, who actually joined us from the White House today. She's professor of nutrition and public health at NYU, author of books including Eat, Drink, Vote, and An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And also we'll wrap up this part of the show and thank Richard Ayborn, president of the Citizens Crime Commission. Richard, thank you so much.
And my pleasure. Anytime, Brian.
Coming up, two more questions about the Bloomberg years, then live coverage of Mayor Bill de Blasio's inauguration and inaugural address. It's a special edition of The Brian Lehr Show. Three questions about the Bloomberg years, followed by live coverage this morning of Bill de Blasio's inauguration and inaugural address. Question number two now about the Bloomberg years. Did Mayor Bloomberg make us less equal? A fundamental question for the history books. Did Bloomberg policies leave too many people behind? Did they exacerbate inequality? Let's take on that one now, and let's go back to Mayor Bloomberg's farewell address to the Association for a Better New York in early December. In this two-minute excerpt, he argues he's made us more equal.
When our administration began, high school graduation rates had been stuck at 50% for 20 years. Think about that, 20 years and no improvement. It was inexcusably wrong. When city government can't see beyond the special interests or beyond the next election, children suffer. But when city government looks ahead and invests in policies and programs that put students first, children succeed. And we've certainly seen that over the past 12 years. Today, not only are high school graduation rates more than 40% higher, but so are college resident readiness rates. And now, 22 of the state's top 25 elementary and middle schools are in the five boroughs. Back in 2001, we didn't have a single school in the top 25 statewide. Today, there is no city in America with a stronger social safety net than New York, and there is no city that has done more to fight poverty than we have. And that's one reason why New York has been the only major city in the nation not to experience an increase in poverty since the 2000 census. The average city saw a 36% increase in poverty. New York saw no increase in poverty whatsoever. Of course, flat is not good enough, but by bucking the trend, we've helped keep thousands of families out of poverty. One way we've fought poverty has been through our Young Men's Initiative, which is the most comprehensive effort any city has made to help those who are most at risk of getting off track, black and Latino young men. And the work that we've done to reform juvenile justice policies is helping to give thousands of our kids a fair shot at staying in school and staying out of trouble. All of these programs and many more are in keeping with the best traditions of New York City as a laboratory for compassionate and innovative social policy.
That excerpt from Mayor Bloomberg's farewell address last week to the Association for a Better New York. But Bill de Blasio was elected overwhelmingly on the issue of rising inequality. So did Mayor Bloomberg make us less equal? We'll talk about it now with Andrew Beveridge, Queens College demographer and the CEO of Social Explorer, which is a demographics mapping site. He's got some census data to share comparing New York in 2000 and in 2012. And Mark Winston Griffith, executive director of the activist group, the Brooklyn Movement Center. Andrew, Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot, Brian. I'm very happy to be here.
Me too. Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, add your oral histories here. Did Bloomberg policies make you less equal? Did Bloomberg leave you behind in some way? And you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. In fact, we've posted a Census Bureau data set that Andrew's been looking at and is helping us chart. There, too, you can see some of these really interesting numbers on our site, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And, Andrew, let's look at some of these numbers. In the speech, the mayor talked about education in the clip we played, including dropout rates. And sure enough, the census numbers show that when Bloomberg took office, 28% of adults over age 25 had less than a high school education. Today, that's down to 20%. And parallel to that, 16% of city adults had bachelor's degrees when Bloomberg was elected. Today, that's up 5 points to 21%. And if you add master's degrees, we have 30% of the city college educated for the first time. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, I think those numbers actually are very much of a national trend. Actually, in the data set that's there, the census has a sort of a dropout rate question, which they ask, are you 16 to 19? Are you attending or you don't have a high school diploma? And that is often used as a proxy for dropout. And that dropout rate really did drop during the Bloomberg administration, both in terms of the reported dropout rate, which, you know, mirrors the high school completion rate, and in terms of the census dropout rate. So I think that that's actually a very good thing. I think that the numbers that really jump out from the chart is when you juxtapose the massive increase in both rent and house value with the decline in median income and actually pretty much income across the board.
Right, and hold that because we're going to talk about that in some detail. But I want to finish the thought, Mark, on the dropout rates. Despite all the controversy over testing and charter schools and other Bloomberg policies, Mark Winston Griffith, a good harbinger of fighting inequality for the future, these dropout numbers?
I don't think they're bad. I think that when you look at New York City and you ask that broader question, have people been left behind, I think you have to dig a little deeper. So, for instance, in the neighborhood where I am, Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights and the Community School District 16 there, you see dropout rates, graduation rates. You see, the mayor referred to college readiness rates. Those rates have not changed very much, and in some instances, they've gotten worse. And so I think it goes back to the narrative that Bill de Blasio put forth, which is this tale of two cities, where there are places and there are people who are doing better, but I think that particularly in areas like this, where the surrounding neighborhood is, say, 75-80% black, and you've got a very you know, sort of a broad range of incomes, the district itself, the traditional public schools here, are overwhelmingly black and overwhelmingly low income. And so people feel as though that they can't go to school in the neighborhood. They either have to go to a different district, they have to go to a charter school, or they have to go to a private school. And so the institutions, the infrastructure that's here right now, I think we see withering in many respects rather than getting better.
Andrew Beveridge, let's get to those median income stats that you were referring to and the cost of housing. Median income is down in the Bloomberg years, according to the Census Bureau stats, from, I see two different ones, either down from $53,000 a year to $51,000.
Yeah, that's right.
Or down from $57,000 to $55,000.
No, that's for the whites.
That's for white people?
Yeah, there's the median income, there's an overall, and then below it's broken down by group.
And, well, by race, again, yeah. Tell me if I'm reading these numbers wrong, but these census numbers look like Latinos took the biggest hit in the last 12 years. That median income for non-Hispanic whites was steady at around $70,000 a year, steady for blacks but around $48,000, and for Latinos down from $40,000 to $37,000 median income per year. So what does that reflect? Is it more poor Mexicans coming in? Is it people here actually making less for the same skills? Can you tell?
You really can't, although, I mean, there are data there that show that the number of Mexicans has gone up substantially, I think, you know, and that's been an ongoing story since there's only about 30 to 40,000 counted Mexicans in the 1990 census, and now there's, let me just quickly look, but there's a really high number now in this, in the data. So the Mexican group growth has been really quite substantial. I think you guys highlighted it on your, you highlighted it on your, on
website.
Your thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so that's I think, that's one of the things that is very, very substantially different. So I think that part of it would be that there's been a very large increase in the Hispanic population, and some of those people do come in with low skills and low levels of education, and so that may in fact be pushing down the median income. The number of Puerto Ricans has declined substantially. I think that the reason people feel so poor in New York, though, the people who are not rich, is that, you know, the rent, you know, the median rent's gone up 27%. The median household income's gone down 4%. Median house value's gone up like something like 68 or maybe even more percent. So you've got, it's very difficult. You know, housing is a huge fraction of a lot of people's of cost. So it's very, very difficult, you know, to make it through. I mean, the proportion of people in New York, I mean, Bloomberg did a lot in a certain sense for affordable housing, but just because of the way the market went, and I think, you know, some of the favoritism in the market, the the affordable housing in New York has really declined. The actual housing that's affordable. I mean, that doesn't mean they haven't built, you know, 64,000 units or something that's, or tried to preserve 64,000 units that are affordable. But, you know, meanwhile, 300,000 or 400,000 affordable units that were in the market are no longer affordable. And I think that that is one of the major drivers of this feeling of people just really can't make it in New York.
So has Mayor Bloomberg left you behind? Gregory on Staten Island, higher on WNYC.
Yes, one of those items had to do with supporting artistic expression. And, well, speaking as a musician, for other performing artists as well, we have not had it easy these last few years, not just the higher rents that the gentleman was referring to pushing out performing arts groups, but Bloomberg has done nothing, so far as I know, about the decline in city-sponsored funding for the arts, or this terrible trend that venues now are expecting musicians to promote their own shows instead of simply to pay them what used to be, where you go in and venues actually pay without expecting to pass the hat. So it's really become a struggle.
Thank you for your call. John in Brooklyn, has Mayor Bloomberg left you behind?
Hello.
Hi, John.
How you doing, buddy?
Good. What's up?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One is, the stress level in New York, I think, has increased dramatically with the rent, the high rents, and trying to find work and pay the rent for families. I think it's tremendously high. And the other thing is, I come home at night, and the amount of homelessness and people with problems. It's just gone out of the sky altogether. I just think it's absolutely disgusting in a city that's this rich, that this many homeless people on the subways at night, and a lot of them are troubled and mentally sick. And I just think it's very, very sad.
John, thank you very much. And the mayor mentioned the poverty rate not rising in the clip that we played. But the amazing New York Times series on that girl in a homeless shelter reminds us that a record 22,000 New York City children are officially homeless today. That's just children, 22,000. And I don't think the Bloomberg administration would deny that stat. Also, City Hall's own numbers are that 46% of the city's population lives in poverty or near poverty. And again, I don't think that they would deny that. That's their own number. And any discussion of inequality in New York has to include housing, as Andrew was referencing, and right. Some of the stats on that, as the median income declines, median rent and home buying costs are way up. Here are some of the numbers from that Census Bureau survey. Median rent up 27% in the 12 Bloomberg years. Median value of a house up from $295,000 to $478,000. That's even after the bubble burst. So if you already owned a home when Bloomberg took office, on average, you're doing very well in that regard, I guess. If not, life is harder from a housing standpoint. How much of that, though, do you think can be attributed to Bloomberg policies rather than national housing or economic trends?
Well, I think part of it is national, because the subsidies for housing have not really changed, except for low-income housing tax credits, since the Reagan administration. So in other words, the number of fully subsidized units, which would be either Section 8 housing or public housing, when those are really the two major subsidy programs, those have not increased at all. There's low-income housing tax credit, and I think there has been some people availing themselves of that, but those are developers, and their low income doesn't necessarily mean as low as a person, as you would find in Section 8 or public housing. And then I think the other thing is that the developing, they keep talking about affordable housing, and you talk to developers, they say, housing's affordable to someone. But, I mean, the truth of the matter is, if you look at the actual development of housing under Bloomberg, it's been at the top, and there's been massive, and people don't really like to talk about this, but there's been massive both tax abatements and tax exemptions for people buying, properties that are very, very expensive. My favorite is a tax subsidy to a $36 million apartment in Time Warner Center. But you go down Fifth Avenue and all of those co-ops, I mean, they'd say, well, Bloomberg can't raise, de Blasio can't raise the rent. If they changed the way in which they valued co-ops, they would have a lot more money coming in from people living on Fifth Avenue.
So, Mark Winston Griffith, same question. And the, one of the stats that I guess Andrew was just referring to from the Census Bureau, the mayor did create an additional 185,000 units of housing in New York, according to these Census Bureau stats. Again, there are 185,000 more units of housing in the city than there were 12 years ago. But talk about that overall inequality and who's left behind, as we've been discussing.
Well, I think that Mayor Bloomberg has had a blind spot. And it's interesting that all these years he's been in office, I've never once heard him use the word gentrification. That is, that there is an anxiety that people are feeling day-to-day living in neighborhoods where they're seeing things becoming more expensive the city becoming, on one level, more livable, but in economic terms, much more unlivable. And so when he talks about, development always sort of being a good thing and we need more rich people in New York City, he just doesn't seem to acknowledge the extent to which the middle class is getting hollowed out. And people just do not feel as though New York City is a place where they can survive. Even when you look at, when he talks about poverty, and you look at, people have forgotten this, but his signature poverty program were the conditional cash transfers, right, which were cash incentives for, kids to get higher grades and doctor visits and, keeping jobs.
You know, so his in
that
many
was
ways,
that was one of his signature programs, right? Which I think he acknowledged was a failure. He cited others in the speech, like the focus on young Black and Latino men.
Right, but what I think is very instructive about that is that in many ways he did not sort of recognize the systemic and the structural aspects of policy of poverty, and oftentimes reduced poverty to, you know, a lack of motivation on the individual level, or just sort of applied his own kind of free market values and principles to it. So I think that that's I think is what made such an opening for de Blasio coming in and talking about, again, the two New York cities. Mm-hmm. He just didn't seem to acknowledge many of the struggles that people were going through that had nothing to do with you know, their lack of motivation, so to speak, but what they were dealing with as far as housing and the cost of living here.
Anything else we haven't talked about on the issue of rising inequality in the Bloomberg years that you would want to throw in? Mark Winston Griffith from the Brooklyn Movement Center?
Well, I mean, I think that we focus so much on, you know, oftentimes on what Bloomberg hasn't done when it comes to poverty and some of his crime policies. I mean, one of the things I do think that is worth mentioning is that although on some level he's preaching to the choir, you know, Bloomberg sort of stands, for instance, on guns, and the way in which he has become a national anti-gun advocate, I think is rather is very admirable and something that that he needs to be recognized for, and I think that is going to play well into his legacy going forward.
And Andrew Beveridge, 30 seconds. Any numbers that we didn't tease out or anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I really think that, you know, the Bloomberg legacy will rise or fall on his development. And we have, you know, all this massive development, you know, Barclays Center, Hudson Yards, on and on and on. Most of it tax exempt, a lot of it with tax subsidies, Yankee Stadium, Citi Field, now Willett's Point. The question is whether or not this is truly sustainable, because lots of the rates and so forth have gone off the tax rolls. So basically what you have is you have a really good tax gift for a lot of developers. Will that trickle down? I think that is still an open question.
Andrew Beveridge, demographer at Queens College, and check out his site, socialexplorer.com, for some great demographics-oriented maps. We've also put some of the census data that he helped provide us with on our page. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to see some of these numbers we've been talking about. And Mark Winston Griffith, executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up after the news, one more question about the Bloomberg years, then live coverage of Mayor Bill de Blasio's inauguration and inaugural address. First, the latest news on WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning and Happy New Year again, everybody. It's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, of course. We are re-airing excerpts of our recent special, Three Questions About the Bloomberg Years, followed then by live coverage of the inauguration of Mayor Bill de Blasio. So one more question about Mayor Mike before we begin our live coverage. Did he secure our city's future? And we return again to Mayor Bloomberg's farewell address before the Association for a Better New York.
We invest in the future. Our predecessors in city government built Central Park when much of Manhattan was farmland and forest. They built subway lines to neighborhoods that didn't yet exist. And they built water tunnels with enough capacity for the city to grow for generations. Then in the 60s and 70s, city government stopped investing in its future. One of our core values was abandoned, and we paid a terrible price for it. Over the past 12 years, we've invested in the future, a non-negotiable priority. We've nearly ready to open a new subway extension, the first subway extension funded by the city in more than 50 years. We've also recreated entirely new public transit systems, the East River Ferry and City Bike, and new taxis. We brought taxi service to areas outside of Manhattan, something the city has been trying to do since the Lindsay administration. We've created more than 800 acres of new parkland, much of it by reclaiming the neglected areas of our waterfront. We've built and preserved enough affordable housing to house the entire city of Atlanta, and then some. We've improved our air and water quality while also making our city more resilient to climate change. And when I think about the city my grandson will come to know as an adult, I think of all the projects that are still years or even decades away from competition. The third water tunnel has more to go. Hudson Yards, Willits Point, the Applied Science Campus on Roosevelt Island, Governor's Island, the Kingsbridge Armory, Brooklyn Bridge Park, Fresh Kills Park, the Staten Island Wheel, Hunters Point South, the storm surge barriers proposed by our special initiative, Rebuilding and Resiliency, and the list goes on and on. Now, I won't be around to cut final ribbons on those projects, and that's fine with me. What matters to me is knowing that those projects will benefit our children and grandchildren for decades to come.
Mayor Bloomberg on December 6th saying goodbye. And it'll be interesting to hear coming up in our inauguration coverage how similarly or differently Mayor de Blasio says hello. But on Bloomberg, now that we've heard from journalists, academics, and activists for most of this program, with me last is one of Mayor Bloomberg's closest aides and staunchest defenders, Stu Loser, former chief spokesman for the mayor, now head of his own political strategy firm. Stu, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And when you talk to Mayor Bloomberg, are there one or two ways that he's been most focused on leaving the city better set up for the future than he found it?
Yeah, absolutely. You heard a lot of that in the speech he just gave. The point he didn't make in that speech, it's kind of in the weeds, but it's good for this conversation, I think, is this. When he came in, people voted for him because they thought Mike Bloomberg was going to run New York City like a business. That was what a lot of people thought in 2001, something he never said. As a matter of fact, it's something his campaign took great pains to never say, because you can't run the government like a business. You can't go, as Mike Bloomberg has said many times, if you have a product line in business, that one that works and one that doesn't work, you put the resources in the one that works. In government, it's the exact opposite. You have to take the resources away from what's working and put it towards what's not working. You can't run government like a business. But what he has done, and I think the speech he just gave, the speech you just quote, reflects it, but he wasn't actually explicit in it, is looked at New York and led like an entrepreneur. So what's that mean? What means when you an entrepreneur sees something, has an idea, the beginning of an idea of something that you need to build, not exactly sure who it is, what it's going to look like, what it's going to do, but knows we sort of have to head in a direction, and you build it without really knowing what it is and what and who's going to benefit. Usually government doesn't do that. Usually government is singularly focused on responding to people who exist and who make their voices heard. Very important.
And this relates to what?
Public health? This relates
crime,
to public health. This relates to crime.
Housing.
This relates to development. In affordable housing, so we've started broken ground or more on some of the largest affordable housing programs in decades. Hunters Point South in Long Island City across from the UN. Gotham West on the west side of Manhattan. City Point in downtown Brooklyn. Via Verde in the South Bronx. None of us know who those people are going to who are going to live there. That's a long away. We don't know who the beneficiaries are. You can't point to who's going to win. You can't point to what the next Foursquare, what the next Tumblr, what the next guilt group is going to be. We don't know who they are. We don't know who they're going to employ. We do know that in the beginning of the first term, Mike Bloomberg, Dan Doktoroff, and their team said we have to diversify the city's economy if we're going to build. We can't be reliant on what it is. And tech is important. We don't exactly know what it's going to look like. That is how he has secured our future. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like in 10 or 20 years. We don't know who's going to be building on the west side of Manhattan, but they will be able to because of Mike Bloomberg.
So, listeners, the third of our three questions about the Bloomberg years, did he secure the city's future? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show for the mayor's former chief spokesman, Stu Loser. And, Stu, I don't know if you heard our previous segment on inequality. You were in the green room. I think you did hear a lot of it. But through surveys and census numbers and the overwhelming nomination and election of Bill de Blasio, and you heard the numbers about median income going down while housing costs are rising so much, there's a pretty pervasive sense that while focusing on the long term, in many ways, a side effect of that, at least, has been a more unequal city with not necessarily more hope for the children being born here today, despite the green sustainability and infrastructure
and schools.
Seeds for the tech economy and other improvements cited in the speech excerpt we played. Is it a disappointment for the mayor, at least that he's perceived that way by many people?
No, and I think you're fairly and appropriately pointed out that of all cities in the United States, New York is the only one that did not show an increase in poverty. And the important point about poverty is important because it's not average. It's not mean. It's not median. It's not like take all the money and divide it and see what everyone's average salary is. It's actual poverty. Now,
he said that in the speech excerpt, but also by his own calculations.
No, you said it in the earlier segment that of all major cities in the United States, New York's the only one that since 2002 hasn't seen a statistical increase in the amount.
But I also cited the stat that poverty or near poverty is up to 46% of the population, according to the administration's own statistics.
That's true. Now, you know, the part of the problem is in judging any administration, in judging any president, any mayor, any governor, what if? If we take a step back, New York has overcome two of the greatest financial crises it has hit, not particularly externally created ones, 2001, post 9/11, and 2008, the financial crisis. Without a doubt, a lot of people are hurting. Without a doubt, they're up and down the economic ladder, and disproportionately in the bottom, who the poor poor tend to be hurt more when people are pushed to the edge. People haven't, there are people who are hurting. However, it's important to not take that out of context. We've grown industries like the hospitality industry, where 370,000 people, many of whom with limited English use or limited English skills, work. We have more New Yorkers working in New York City than at any time in the history of the country. We have actually such incredible employment numbers that people are questioning the unemployment number, the utility of the economic, the unemployment rate as an economic model, because it doesn't fully explain how we can have more people working and still show problems like this. Look, these are tough times. I think that by both investing in the short term and the long term, in public schools and in parks and in affordable housing, the mayor has done an extraordinary job in weathering two storms, both of which were supposed to sink New York City, 2001 and 2008.
So has Mayor Bloomberg secured the city's future? Craig in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to you guys. I want to say quickly, I don't believe so. I even though the mayor's former associate said they didn't come in the office saying that he would be a business manager to the city, a lot of people elected him because of that. I think he won over Fernando Ferrer on the basis of that, because Freddie Ferrer would have came in the office, I believe, because he said after 9/11, when everybody said, let's let Giuliani stay on, he said, no, if you're not ready to run the first day, then you don't need to be mayor. And then Bloomberg picked up steam with this. We need a manager. You know, the city's under financial. And this guy hopped into that, talking about how he weathered the storm. With that said, the union contracts. It's shameful that three terms he did nothing for the major. Sanitation, correction, and fire department. And to leave that with the next mayor and the city with that burden and what it's going to cause and all the property tax that we gave the people to as a reward to do business with the city. And a lot of stuff that he's claiming with the Central Park, that was partnerships with people that would have been there and would have did that stuff already.
And Craig, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. Thank you very much. And on Craig's point about finances and the contracts, one topic that the mayor didn't mention in his Building for the Future clip was city finances.
Mm-hmm.
And he has budget watchdog critics who also come from a much different place than the caller did in terms of their point of view, who say he's been okay but not great in this regard.
Well, okay, a couple of points. I appreciate and understand where Craig is coming from. Factually, he's not correct about the union contracts As a matter of fact, the union contracts for up until the financial crisis, up until 2008, contracts were renewed in New York City before they were due, which is a historical anomaly, almost never happened, and unions got significant raises. He mentioned sanitation. No union got more money, got greater incentive raises than the sanitation department did because they were most innovative in finding ways to have cost savings, split trucks for recycling and general refuse, and splitting the cost savings. Just not to say that the teachers didn't get a 43% raise in base salaries, which they did. Cops, firefighters, extraordinary increases actually in the first 2 years. What happened is in 2008, as the financial crisis hit, as the depth of what was going to happen became clear, and the general instability, the talks broke down. It's important to note that the New York Times labor correspondent, not us, not me, but the New York Times labor correspondent Steve Greenhouse has pointed out that it is the unions that walked away. They walked away because they felt that they were going to get a better deal from the next mayor, which is their right. The you ask about the finances in general, you sort of can't have it both ways.
And let me read a quote about that. This is a critical article by Greg David in Crain's mm-hmm. early this year, and he writes, when the mayor took office in 2002, the total outstanding debt of the city was $55 billion. This year, the Citizens Budget Commission estimates the total reached $110 billion, that increase 100%. He says, that may sound bad, but it's actually worse than you think. Remember, like the federal government, the city is benefiting from historically low interest rates. At some point, interest rates will go up, and you should hope they do, he adds, because that will mean the economy is improving, and so will the annual debt service cost.
Right. Now, a couple of points. One, when I cited before about the outside experts saying that the growth in New York City's jobs is so extraordinary, the number of people employed, that it calls into question the unemployment rate as a useful figure, that was actually Greg David. So in fairness, I want Greg to be seen on both sides. He's not. He's fair, and he puts it both ways. What you're talking about, long-term costs and debt service, is significantly, not entirely, but significantly due to pension costs, to defined benefit plans, to health care plans, and particularly retiree health care costs, most of which you can't touch under New York City law. And the mayor has tried mightily to try and get health care savings from public unions. Kaz Holloway has worked heroically on this. Many of the people who are sympathetic to organized labor and to the city's incredible unionized workforce are disinclined to have greater participation from the union in healthcare costs. You sort of can't have it both ways. You can't say you can't be among the people who in 2008, before the financial crisis, complained, criticized, and attacked the mayor for saving billions of dollars for a rainy day, and then complained that there's not money to be spent. Now, if we had spent the money and not saved for a rainy day, saved $4 billion when people were hurting and people were hungry, and people said we need more homeless shelters, which we did, and we need more services for veterans and schools, which we did, but nonetheless, under that pressure, the mayor built, not knowing who it would be, but built for the future and saved that money. If we hadn't done that, then, in fact, we would have not only the problem of expired labor contracts, we would have many fewer city workers. We wouldn't have been able to get here without massive layoffs, which we did because we saved that money.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we're asking three questions about the Bloomberg years. Did Mayor Bloomberg make you healthier? Did Mayor Bloomberg leave you behind? And the third of the three that we're in now, did he secure our city's future, with former Bloomberg spokesman Stu Lozer? And Nancy in the Bronx, did Mayor Bloomberg secure our city's future?
Oh, well, wow. Thank you for taking my call. I hadn't heard anybody mention the 311 system yet, and I think that Mayor Bloomberg, that it came about during his time as the mayor, and I have found this to be an amazing system, and I really hope that the next mayor keeps it going at the same quality, because not only can you pick up the phone and find out that there's a snow day or that parking regulations are different, but I've actually called about things in my neighborhood. Potholes that are really dangerous have been fixed within 24 hours. When we had the West Nile scare, if there was a dead bird, it sat there for 2 days. I called, and within hours, somebody was calling me and saying, where is it? And they found it, and they took it. I have found that the 311 system is a very positive thing for our city, and I hope that it goes on.
Nancy, appreciating the public information and access infrastructure innovated by Mayor Bloomberg. Tom in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I wanted to address the issue of perspective. Not only am I an artist who's a great appreciator of the historical architecture and neighborhoods of our city, but the perspective of your guest versus the perspective of the average person. The word blight could be defined as, in my eyes, a new development, big shiny building with a CVS and a Starbucks. The old businesses are gone. The tenants that were secure have lost their place. And that is my definition of blight.
There are a lot of people who feel that way, Stu.
Well, okay. And it certainly are. Now, a lot of these big shiny buildings are affordable housing projects. We actually created 1.8 million square feet of retail space as a result of affordable housing development. A lot of that is inclusionary zoning, which is when the city makes affordable housing more appealing to builders, to the private sector, through letting them build higher if they have affordable housing. It created about 4,000 units of affordable housing, which within the universe of what's able to accomplish in New York is not insignificant. Within the universe of the 175,000 units that the mayor was able to construct or preserve, it's a small part, but it's an important part. And by the way, something that, Nancy talked about things that she hopes the next administration continues. All indications are that this inclusionary zoning is something that the de Blasio administration is going to continue, probably differently and with tweaks, as you would imagine. But they are going to build on that. There are a lot of people in New York who are nostalgic for a departed New York. One website talks about the gorgeous decay, the good old gorgeous decay. That's not Mike Bloomberg's vision. He's a builder. He's an investor. He's a developer. He's trying to build us for a future. And yeah, there's a lot of buildings and a lot of companies in those office spaces and a lot of people living here.
What would you do differently? What do you think the mayor would do differently if he could have a do-over on something?
Well, maybe harder, faster, more aggressive on schools. You always wish you could do more. Every time we made an education announcement over the 8 years, the 8 or 12 years, but I overlapped with him for 6.5 years, and I've been paying attention very closely for 8 of them. The argument was, well, why didn't you do this sooner? Oh, if it's such a great idea to have this amount of transparency, give this kind of information to parents, why didn't you do it earlier? And his argument was like, we were ending social promotion, things that people forgot we did, which was a big fight and a hard fight. And now when we did it the first time, it was highly controversial, and then each time less controversial. You sort of wish that, you forget what you've done and you wish you could have do what you're doing now earlier. I guess that would be my answer.
One more clip, and you referred to this off the air recently, to this, and I know you've heard it ad nauseum. Tell us why you think this little Mike Bloomberg soundbite has landed in the public consciousness from a heat wave a few years ago, referring to hot playground equipment.
It was hot. We'll have to live through it. Certainly nothing is dangerous. If it's hot, don't sit on it.
Why does everyone know that clip?
Well, because you play it and everyone listens to you. And as I think I said to you off the air, your show airs when generally at the same time the mayor is doing press conferences. So even when I was the mayor's chief spokesperson, I didn't fully understand the impact of it. But more importantly, because in a soundbite, it sort of encapsulates everything that the mayor is saying. Nancy was talking about 311. The essence of 311 is that everyone has equal opportunity to government services. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be a lobbyist. You don't have to be a member of a union. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be whatever. You don't have to know. You don't have to be an expert. Know your way around to know that Department of Environment, the DEP runs fire hydrants and not the fire department. You call and say, there's a fire hydrant on my corner. It's leaking. Someone comes and fixes it. That's all you need to know. There is that fundamental democratization in that answer. People saw Mike Bloomberg saying, I'm not going to stand for this kind of nonsense. You know, like, it is what it is. It's hot outside. Let's not get crazy about it. We're here to do jobs, and that sort of boils it down to, you know, everything you talk about a mayor who's unbought, uninfluenced, who does things, agree or disagree, because he thinks it's the right thing to do, not because of some donor or because of some ally who scratched his back. That boils down to, that is often boiled down to, I think, in that if it's hot, don't sit on it, sort of plain speaking.
So to wrap it up, want to take a stab at the first line in the history books? 50 years from now, 100 years from now, Michael Bloomberg was mayor from 2002 to 2013. Michael Bloomberg, who
built the city, invested and built the city for the future, for a future that was a future, a redevelopment and growth in the days in which after 9/11, when people thought that the city's best days were behind us, clearly the city's greatest days were ahead of us because of Mike Bloomberg, because of the investments he was able to make, both in the short term and in the long term.
Stu Loser, former chief spokesman for Mayor Bloomberg, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
And that concludes our special three questions about the Bloomberg years.
In the decades ahead, mayors will come and mayors will go. There will be ups and downs, triumphs and tragedies. But if we always remember our values, if we honor them and work to live up to them and defend them against attack, if we all pull together and stand up for one another, we will remain what we are today, the greatest city in the world. That is my heartfelt hope. That is my wish for the future. And that is what I want more than anything else for my little grandson and all the generations to come. Thank you. God bless our great city.
And there you have our pre-inaugural special, three questions about the Bloomberg years. And now we turn the page to the de Blasio years with live coverage of his inauguration and inaugural address. Our live coverage begins right after this.